Welcome to the Diet Doctor Podcast with Dr. Brett Scher. Today I'm joined by Dr. Ronald Krauss. Now, Dr. Krauss is really a luminary in the field of lipid research, and he's got a laundry list of accolades with over 450 publications, mostly in the field of lipidology. And he's the director of atherosclerosis research at the Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute. He's a professor of medicine at UCSF, professor of nutritional science at Berkeley. He's been involved in development of cholesterol guidelines, what's called the ATP program in the past, and he was the founder of the American Heart Association Council on Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Metabolism. He definitely has one foot firmly planted in the cholesterol world and one foot firmly planted in the lifestyle and nutrition world. And I think that's one of the things that makes his perspective so unique. And let's be honest, we can all kind of get too entrenched in certain paradigms. One paradigm that all LDL is bad no matter what. One paradigm that LDL does not matter at all. And clearly, I think neither one is truly accurate. And it's a much more nuanced discussion than that. And that's why I really appreciate Dr. Krauss's his approach to this and his knowledge. And let's face it, I mean, he was the pioneer in identifying the size and the density and the different varieties of LDL cholesterol. So when it comes to understanding the nuance and that not LDL is the same, he is definitely the man to talk to. So we cover a lot of ground in this discussion about LDL, about lipids in general, and of course, what it means to your lifestyle and how your lifestyle impacts that. So sit back, get out a pen and paper. There's a lot to digest here, but I really hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Ronald Krauss. Dr. Ronald Krauss, thank you so much for joining me on the Diet Doctor podcast today.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, in the intro, you've obviously have been around the world of lipids and lipid research and very proficient for a number of decades. You've seen a number of changes in the world of lipidology and the world of nutrition and lifestyle. And one of the things that I appreciate most about you is that you were the founder of the AHA Council on Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Metabolism, and you've been very involved in how nutrition affects lipidology. Give us, if you can, just a brief overview of how you've seen the sea of nutrition and lipids and the interaction sort of change over the time that you've been involved in this.
Okay, so let me do that in the context of my role with the American Heart Association.
Okay.
Early on, I became involved with what was then called the Nutrition Committee that, among other things, set guidelines for heart disease prevention with diet periodically. And one of my first exercises was to update those guidelines, and that I did when I became chair of the Nutrition Committee. And I'd inherited a set of rules that were implemented over the years that emphasized reducing fat and replacing the fat with carbohydrate. It was this low-fat message. This was not that long ago. It was, well, for me anyway, it was about 20-plus years ago. That was the prevailing recommendation. But at the same time, I was doing research, trying to understand the role of lipoprotein metabolism in atherosclerosis as it's affected by diet. And so one of the first studies that I did to address that was to test the effect of the standard low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet in a group of volunteers who had a lipid profile that most of whom were normal to start with. And it was really to see whether or not we could improve certain features of the profile. We can talk about that perhaps in a few moments. But what I found was, to my surprise, that the standard low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet actually worsened the lipid profile in a substantial subset of this population in ways that have really very strongly related to heart disease risk outcomes, higher levels of LDL particles, and higher levels of triglyceride, which is another risk factor for heart disease. And it wasn't a complete surprise because looking back over the years, others have shown that high carbohydrate diets can induce a high triglyceride level, but the effect on the LDL was really what was quite surprising. And as a result of that, and further research that I engaged in to explore that mechanism further, I changed my views on what the proper diet should be for heart disease prevention. One issue is individualizing the approaches to people based on their metabolic profile. So there's an issue of not everybody needs the same diet. But for the overall recommendations, I tried to move the Heart Association a little bit further away from the low-fat approach. And I wrote another set of dietary guidelines 5 years later that reflected that. But it was like trying to move a mountain, because the amount of investment in that old message was so strong that there was resistance to doing that. Over time, I think, with further research, which we can talk about, that approach, I think, has been challenged by many others. And that change, I think, is now in play, although organizations like the Heart Association and even the U.S. Dietary Guidelines that are charged with making public recommendations still put a great deal of emphasis on the fat side of the equation, and are beginning to be more concerned about the carbohydrate trade-off. But I think it could be taken even farther.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there, and just in that one statement that you made, that these guidelines were already set in place and believed to be true, and yet you had research showing not only was it maybe a neutral effect of what the guidelines were, but a deleterious, potentially deleterious effect.
For a significant subset of the population, not for everyone, but
right.
but enough people to be concerning. Yes.
Right, and yet still they haven't come 180, which you think they would once the research came out, because once you're entrenched in a guideline like that, it's hard to back out of that room and change your tune.
Yeah, and then you have to look at the overall evidence, not just about what happens to lipids on various diets, but how do those diets relate to heart disease outcomes. And I've been more engaged recently in evaluating the literature that addresses that. And some of this, I'm sure you've already talked about in other contexts, but it's clear that the evidence that was thought to exist linking saturated fat in particular to heart disease risk didn't hold up very well when we looked at the actual literature. There are issues about what one substitutes for saturated fat potentially being an important factor, and there's now more or less general agreement that substitution of carbohydrate for saturated fat, which was really what was the consequence of the earlier guidelines, people were encouraged to drop saturated fat, and they were many times eating the wrong kinds of carbohydrates in considerable amounts. That approach, I think, has now been shown to be a factor in increasing heart disease risk.
Increasing heart disease
outcomes. So this line of research has really converged, I think, with a broader look at heart disease risk and its relationship to diet, giving us a little more latitude on the fat side, although I think it still could go higher, and more attention to the carbohydrate side, with particular emphasis on simple sugars. The total carbohydrate load is still, I think, a matter for discussion as to how to deliver recommendations for overall carbohydrate intake to the population. There's so many nuances. I mean, there's the issue of reducing carb itself overall. There's the issue of using carbs that are really whole grain, and whole grain itself is something that many people don't even quite understand.
Right.
The whole grain that works is where the kernels of the grains, like brown rice or whole kernel rye, where you haven't ground it up, that's a fiber-rich source that is probably okay for a number of health outcomes, but that's not what most people understand. And they wind up just going overboard on carbs. So one way of dealing with that is to just tell them to drop the total carbs.
Not try to
get into what kinds of carbs.
Right. Quality of carbs matters.
It does matter. It's very hard to convey that information in a way that the public can implement.
Right.
And the food industry has not been particularly helpful.
I wonder why.
Well, they were initially on board with the low-fat message. That's, in fact, what took my predecessors down the garden path of making incorrect public health recommendations. And the food industry was helping that along by providing high sugar, low fat products like Snackwells. And that was sort of the classic example of going the wrong way on the carb story. But trying to educate people on, and the food industry, on trying to provide a healthful form of something that the food industry could market is very difficult, since most of what we are now trying to promote in my current approach, which I think meshes with some of the new aspects of the U.S. dietary guidelines, is to think about foods, mm-hmm. and as much as possible, to think about foods that you don't necessarily have to get in a box. Because once the food industry gets involved with packaging and processing, things change, and there isn't a strong advocacy on the marketing side for the kinds of foods that carry a lot of health, the whole grain products, the products that have the kinds of things you get in vegetables and fruits.
Right.
Everybody talks about that, but when you go to get your food in the supermarket and you get it in a box, it doesn't necessarily have the same qualities.
But yet those boxes can sometimes say heart healthy, or, you know, they say gluten free and low fat, and
it's very confusing. Implies
health. And yet instead of talking about carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, we should be talking about food. Like you're saying, it should come from the ground like a vegetable, should come from an animal, should not come from a box. And simple messages like that sort of get lost, don't they?
Yeah, and I think there's more and more recognition of that approach.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to deliver that to the public in an actionable way, given our current distribution of food and, you know, where the supermarkets are and who can buy the groceries and who can afford to buy, for example, fish, which is another thing that we think has value in the diet. These are all kinds of approaches that are not always easy to implement for social and economic reasons.
And it doesn't help that age-old subsidies have been helping promote sort of the wrong types of foods and not the right types of foods, and that's a whole other battle.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely.
But so, I want to focus a little bit more on the LDL.
Sure.
So you mentioned the study that you did to help sort of change the tune of the AHA, and there's the big concepts are we following the right markers? Because anybody goes to their regular doctor, even their cardiologist, and the first thing they want to talk about is the LDL-C.
Right.
Is that the right marker to follow?
Well, it's not the best marker. LDL-C stands for LDL cholesterol, and that is the portion of the cholesterol in the blood that is carried around in the blood on particles, which are LDL particles. So LDL-C is potentially a marker for the numbers of those particles, but it doesn't fully reflect the numbers of those particles, and it's the numbers of the LDL particles more than the cholesterol content that determines atherosclerosis risk. So traditionally over the years, LDL-C has served as a easily measured laboratory test. I was involved when I was actually at the NIH for a number of years at the time that the LDL-C test was actually developed. It's actually in most labs calculated. It's not a super accurate measurement, and that's another issue. But it took hold because people were able to use it in large population studies and in clinical trials, and the literature, therefore, is heavily weighted towards LDL-C as sort of the be-all and the end-all. Yet it's the particles that matter. And there are a huge number of situations in the world of the clinic, particularly in individuals who have metabolic syndrome, which is this constellation of risk factors that include high triglyceride and low HDL, where LDL cholesterol does not really reflect the true atherogenic potential, the true cardiovascular risk, because in that syndrome, there can be an increased numbers of LDL particles, but they are small particles which have less cholesterol, and that's really been the focus of my research, was identifying those particles and showing that they are a predictor of risk even when LDL cholesterol is normal. And so that's a significant percentage of the population where LDL cholesterol does not truly reflect the risk. And it can sometimes overrepresent the risk because there are a set of particles on the other side of the spectrum that are large LDL that have actually more cholesterol, but their association with heart disease risk is really quite low. In fact, there's a number of studies which I've talked about. A lot of people still don't really register that there's really no obvious relationship of those particles to risk.
So some would argue if you cancel that out by accounting for the number of particles, then the size has less of an impact. But I think you would disagree with that statement.
Well, it's a matter of how you frame the question. The numbers of LDL particles is a desirable metric for heart disease risk. And when the particle number is elevated in general, that tends to be correlated with increased levels of small LDL particles. The number of individuals in the population who have high LDL particles based on the larger LDL is a minority. So when one measures LDL particles and says the size isn't important, well, it is, because those are small LDL particles you're measuring. But what matters is it's not so much the size, but the numbers of those particles. So people confuse those concepts, and to me it's a relatively simple notion to say that the total number of LDL particles is what one should be concerned about, and that when the particle count is elevated, it more often than not represents these small LDL.
When it's elevated and they're predominantly the larger LDL, is that usually in the metabolically healthy person who has elevated LDL for some reason, but not because they have insulin or they have insulin resistance or diabetes or metabolic syndrome?
Well, there is a category in the population that fits the criteria that you've just described, in whom not only do they have a healthy metabolic profile in general, insulin sensitivity, triglyceride levels, and normal HDL levels are high. That's another marker of low heart disease risk. That constellation can be associated with increased levels of larger LDL particles. But here is where it gets a little thorny, because there are people out there who have genetic disorders that cause their LDL levels to skyrocket. And that's because the LDL is not being taken out of the bloodstream effectively. And those people can have large LDL particles, but they're hanging around too long. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the theme that I've been trying to promote as an underlying concept to help people grapple with these distinctions is atherosclerosis, which is the basic phenomenon that leads to vascular disease, as you know, and heart events and strokes, is built on the accumulation of LDL particles in the artery wall. And if the particles in the blood are circulating long enough, there's going to be a greater tendency of those particles to wind up in the wrong place. So it's what we call the residence time. And the smaller particles have a long residence time by virtue of their structure. And we don't have to go into the reasons for that, but it's been well established that they are cleared much less effectively than larger particles. They hang around longer, and that's clearly, I think, in my view and in those of others, a basis for understanding why they're associated with risk. Well, if you have a defect in the other, in the receiving end, where the liver
so the
is
other
incapable,
receptors.
The receptors are defective, that can also lead to increased circulation time. And there the LDL particle number still is important, but they could well be larger particles. Because the defect is not in the particle, it's in the receptor. So that's why I do what I do. There's cardiologists such as yourself interested in this field have played a great role in helping to elevate recognition of prevention through LDL and other lipid modifications. Use of statins, for example, was greatly enhanced by the involvement of cardiologists in clinical trials. The lipidologists can go into a little more detail than isn't usually possible in other clinical settings, based in part on using the right kind of tests,
right,
that can distinguish these different particles and make clinical recommendations on an individual basis. I see patients, I can make generalizations, and we've made some here,
right,
about large and small LDL, but I see patients who have large LDL, and I worry about them sometimes because of other factors, genetic.
So if they have familial hypercholesterolemia,
if they have a family history, a family history of heart disease, or if they have other known risk factors, I tend to take that more seriously and hedge one's bets, and not say, "Oh, don't worry about this." And I'm facing, in the low carb community, your listeners, a significant subset of people that would like to think that LDL isn't harmful at all, because after all, the benefits of low carb diet are so strong, even when LDL goes up, which it can sometimes go up rather high in some of these patients, that must be okay because the people are healthy and they have this other their general metabolic profile is good, their insulin sensitivity is good, they don't have any coronary calcium. So there is this tension about extrapolating the kind of work that I've done to an extreme, saying that if you have this high LDL, and particularly if there are large LDL particles, don't have to worry about it. And I'm a little nervous about making that recommendation to every patient I see.
Sure, and that's understandable. And, as a cardiologist, I get nervous under that setting as well. And a lot of it is just what we've been told for decades and decades. But I think, to be fair, this population is really underrepresented by the current literature that's out there.
Yes.
And so we really don't know. The LDL studies have looked at standard American diets, have looked at low-fat diets, have looked at general population, haven't looked at this specific subset. And I think that would be so interesting. That's the information we need to say, is it safe or is it not? Now, until then, we still have to decide what to do with that patient sitting across from us. And that's when we have to incorporate the whole profile, their metabolic health, the size and density of the LDL, their HDL, their triglycerides, and the other benefits they get from the diet, and then make an individualized decision. But can't say, nope, LDL doesn't matter, forget about it. And on the same token, can't say, yes, any elevated LDL needs a statin right now. It's more nuanced than that.
You've framed that perfectly, yes.
Thank you.
I completely agree. That's exactly the right approach.
Now, are there other things we can do to try and get an idea of residence time in someone who doesn't have, or even someone who does have FH? Because when you look at the FH subset, it's not 100%. Not everybody gets coronary disease in their 40s and 50s, and there's some data suggest if you don't, you might live even a little longer. But how do we get a better sense of residence time?
The short answer is we don't have a good test for that specifically. In fact, I've been talking to colleagues who do studies of metabolic signatures using metabolomics and mass spec. We're interested in identifying molecules on the particles that might reflect their residence time. And in principle, I think there's a reasonable shot at being able to do that, but we're way far away from even initiating those kinds of studies. And so we are left with, at least for the small LDL individual, there I think the data are sufficiently compelling to me that that having an increased level of small particles does implicate residence time as a factor.
Mm-hmm. Now, does small LDL tend to be a proxy for insulin resistance and prediabetes, or do you see them also separated from that?
Yeah, no, that's another very good question. I hang out a lot with people who are interested in insulin resistance. I'm actually an endocrinologist by training, and I was very close with the late Jerry Reaven, who was the endocrinologist at Stanford, who put that on the map. Insulin resistance does play a central role in many of the manifestations of the lipid disorders that we see, high triglyceride, low HDL, and it does contribute to the small LDL trait. Having said that, the overlap is not by any means complete, and because I tend to see a lot of patients in whom I can characterize all of these metabolic features, I can speak at least based on that experience to the fact that there are people whose insulin sensitivity is really very good, but they have a genetic predisposition to the small LDL trait itself, that there is something affecting lipoprotein metabolism that doesn't come through insulin resistance. So there are people, and in fact, there's a larger proportion of the population, I think, who have the dyslipidemia, those with and without insulin resistance in total than those who are at risk because of insulin resistance alone. This metabolic trait with small LDL is really prevalent. We did just one study in healthy but somewhat overweight, not obese men, and the prevalence of the phenotype, that is just whether they have mainly small versus large LDL, was almost 50%.
Oh, wow.
So as one deals with populations that are more representative, unfortunately, of the average American in terms of body fat, waist circumference, the kinds of things that predispose to insulin resistance, we're exposing more of the small LDL phenotype. But then in many of those individuals, when one tries to reverse it, and this is something I will be talking about more in the talk I'm giving here at this meeting, we can reverse that phenotype by reducing carbohydrate or reducing weight or both, but there remains a residual group of people who appear to be genetically hardwired. Fortunately, it's a minority. So the answer is, for the most part, there's an overlap, but there still are people who have an independent lipid trait that needs attention.
And is there any difference in outcome between the two that
we
you're aware of?
Yeah, no, we don't know. Just because there haven't, we don't really have good integration of detailed metabolic measurements with the kinds of clinical data that are coming from outcome studies.
Yeah.
The outcome studies rely on sort of the high throughput, inexpensive screening kinds of tests, and it's even been hard to generate enthusiasm for another test, which I think has a role in clinical practice, that's apolipoprotein B, which mm-hmm. is a marker of the number of particles. That's a pretty simple test to do, and I've been an advocate for at least taking that step, if not going farther into measuring the different particles themselves. But there are a lot of studies that don't even have that measurement. And if they do, sometimes they don't publish the results.
So it seems the consensus is starting to change, certainly in the field of lipidology and hopefully in the field of cardiology, that LDLP, ApoB are the better markers than LDLC, and that knowing the size and density of your LDL particles is certainly helpful to inform lifestyle changes. But yet it seems like most people have to fight with their doctors to get those measured. Why the disconnect?
Part of the problem, and I've been indirectly responsible for this problem, is the methodology and the nomenclature that has been used in the world of the clinical laboratory, because I actually introduced the first clinical testing for this, which was an electrophoresis procedure, which was really completely quantitative. It was a way of getting a semi-quantitative assessment. But we were talking about different kinds of LDL using that measurement. But then there were a couple of new methods, including another one that I developed, that went much, much farther in terms of being able to quantitate the numbers of particles. But they use different principles, these methods. One of them uses something called NMR, mass spectroscopy. My method uses something called ion mobility. And we haven't yet joined forces. So clinicians from the clinical laboratories can be confused as to what it is they should be measuring. And we don't quite know what the targets should be because there haven't been really extensive studies to establish anything like targets, although now the guidelines for cholesterol have abandoned targets anyway, so maybe they're not needed, which I tend to disagree with. So people are confused in part by the methodology, and it's also a little bit daunting to see the information that comes through with these tests, because the way the reports are annotated, while they attempt to be helpful to the clinicians, I think still leave a lot of questions as to what this means. So what I've been doing is an N of one, and others have been doing it more broadly, whenever possible, try to educate people on the use of these tests. And once they get a feel for it, I think it becomes much more attractive to them. In fact, when I first discovered that there were these subclasses, it's been now 30-some years ago, actually, I faced a tremendous amount of resistance among my colleagues. It took me, it took about 10 or 15 years of just, believe it or not, of hammering away that this even exists because people were not able to see it in their own laboratories. Uh-huh. And I had this very, what they called esoteric at the time, some people still call it esoteric, methodology, and they weren't doing it themselves. What happened was, as the methods became more accessible and other people started to adopt it, they say, wow, this is obvious.
Right.
And now it's in the textbooks, and I don't even get a credit for it.
You fought the battle for decades.
I fought very hard for this, yeah. And I feel that I've at least gotten this MyLDL trait as part of the metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance syndrome, established that now that is in the Bible.
I guess one of the other arguments, though, is some would say it's an added cost without a clear added benefit beyond non-HDL cholesterol. And
right.
Because you're talking about the whole population. And there's probably a subset where that may be true, but it seems like there's a huge subset where that still is not true, that people just don't recognize.
Right. Well, I see, again, it's hard to talk about the population as a whole based on my experience or anything even in the literature, because in my case, I see people in whom these other measurements don't adequately define risk. And on the science side, I sometimes have to deal with people who make all their clinical recommendations based on the last patient they saw or anecdotal evidence, and I think there's problems there. However, my anecdotal evidence, which I will give more credit to, is that there are people who come in, and I just saw one last week, whose father had an early heart attack, who had this lipid profile with small LDL, and the lipids were perfectly normal. Hmm. And in fact, it's been very difficult to reverse that trait without medication. So that's an example, which I think is not uncommon, of a genetic underpinning that's masked by standard lipid levels. And there are people out there like that who would not get picked up by a standard lipid test and who should be intervened on. And family history can be helpful, but not everybody has an informative family history.
Right.
It's not the greatest clinical test.
Right.
But we see it. There's another test, by the way, which I think deserves mention that is part of this overall assessment, and that's called lipoprotein little a, or LP little a, which is another form of LDL-type particle in the blood that has a very strong genetic determinant. What we found is the combination of people who have a relatively high level of this LPA, and we think maybe as much as a third of the population has levels that potentially would increase the risk of heart disease. If that's coupled with small LDL, and there's any kind of family history at all, people are dropping dead of heart attacks in their 50s. But the lipids, these are not picked up by the standard lipids.
Not picked up by a standard LDL-C or LDL-P, but this informs you a little bit more about the type of LDL that's there.
Well, LDL-P can help, but it's still not as specific as the small LDL measurement.
Right. So LP little a tends to be a little more prothrombotic, potentially, pro-inflammatory. Does it also have a higher residence time as well?
Yes. Yeah. It has very slow clearance by the LDL receptor, and it tends to get oxidized relatively easily, which is one of the things that happens to small LDL as well that makes them more toxic to the arteries.
Right. So very important test to measure. Now, the traditional teaching is you measure it once, and there's really not much to do about it in terms of treatment. Of course, there's research being done with these antisense RNAs, but for the time being, do we have much to address it?
Not much. One of the treatments that is currently out of fashion, nicotinic acid, can lower LP little a, but the argument against it is we don't have evidence that lowering LP little a with niacin is beneficial. Some of the newer approaches, new anti-PCSK9 antibody that is being used in high-risk patients can lower LP little a. It's one of the more attractive features of that, although You can't get the insurance people to cover it for OPA lowering. It's not a bona fide indication. But you're right. With that exception, for the most part, Lp(a) is relatively fixed genetically. The value of it, and I believe there is value to screening, is to help give a broader picture of the overall risk, particularly in the context of situations where you're not sure whether one should be aggressively lowering LDL, for example. So this brings in the concept, which I will take a few seconds to emphasize, is absolute risk versus relative risk.
Very good.
So LPA increases the risk of heart attacks when it's elevated by as much as a factor of threefold, depending on the cut point, but it's pretty powerful. That's relative risk. But you're multiplying that relative risk by the absolute risk overall. And so if the absolute risk based on every other measurement is very low, multiplying that time by three is still going to give you a low number. If it were zero, it would be zero. So what we do, I think justifiably, is to be more aggressive in lipid management and risk management in general to lower the absolute risk in patients who have a high LPA and a strong family history. And in my experience, again, I've been doing this a long time, and I have patients whose siblings dropped dead or had a stroke in their 40s who had high Lp(a), and I've been treating them, and they're now in their 70s. The patients are in their 70s. So I think we've found a way to overcome that genetic risk.
Well, it's a great point to bring up the relative versus absolute risk reduction, because it's something that confuses people and confuses clinicians as well.
Yeah.
Partly driven by big pharma, I would say.
They love
to promote relative risks. It's a sexier number. It's a more catchy number.
A 50% reduction in risk, isn't that great? Well, if the risk is here, that 50% is small.
Right. So it doesn't just apply to drugs. It applies to lipid markers as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, interestingly, I have to throw this out there. Up until a couple of weeks ago, I thought Lp(a) was something you could not change with lifestyle because it was genetically set. I don't know if you're familiar with Dave Feldman at cholesterolcode.com and his colleague Siobhan Huggins. She did an N-of-1 experiment, which, take it for what it is, an N-of-1 experiment, where just changing her dietary consumption, she was able to see a huge swing in her Lp(a), which was shocking to me. And I hope there's more coming on this topic, because it's traditionally been taught you can't affect it with lifestyle, but here we have some evidence that maybe you can.
So there's two features of that. I wasn't familiar with that particular story, but there are two components there that I think are relevant. One is, in fact, I published on this, going back to the traditional low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, which is supposed to be good.
Right.
It can raise Lp(a). So Lp(a) can go up with high carb, and so the converse can be true as well. There can be some reduction. It tends to be relatively fixed, i.e. the changes in general are small, but they're in the direction that if you go on this kind of a diet with dropping carbs, that you may have some benefit. But the second component is genetics, because there's at least 50 different genetic subtypes of Lp(a), and there are some that are more responsive to X and others that are unresponsive. There's some that we follow over time and they go like this, and we never quite know exactly what's, they go up and down.
Right.
And there's others that are rock solid. So there's a genetic component. It's sort of one of the prime examples of a complex genetic trait that is very difficult to dissect on an individual basis. We don't have ways of knowing who has which genetic marker and how that's going to respond to diet. But this may be part of the story for that N of one.
Good point. Good point. So one other marker I wanted to bring up, or I guess more than just a marker, is ratios, right? Because we talk a lot about individual markers, and there's also an important of ratios. So I talked to Professor Andrew Menti with the PURE study, and one of the most interesting things about the PURE study was, again, it showed LDL-C is not a very good marker for cardiovascular outcomes, and what a better marker was the ApoB to ApoA ratio. And that was really the best one, but again, not one that gets measured very often. So how do you see the role of ApoB to ApoA ratio?
Well, I think it has a lot of merit, because the numerator is a measure of the number of LDL particles, and in fact, overall, not just LDL, but all of the atherogenic ApoB-containing particles. That's good. The denominator is reflecting a protein that is responsible mechanistically for the benefit that has been attributed to HDL and heart disease risk. We can get into ApoA versus HDL cholesterol. That's another example where the HDL cholesterol is taking us down the path where that marker is not so informative because it's not necessarily reflecting something that can be reflected by ApoA. ApoA1 specifically, it's different forms of ApoA. So the ratio of ApoB to ApoA1, I think, has merit as a risk assessment tool. The ratio of cholesterol to HDL cholesterol also works pretty well,
right,
as a risk marker. The problem is that we can't necessarily translate that risk marker to a target of treatment.
Mm.
If you start treating a ratio, you get into some potentially very inappropriate outcomes. Trying to, for example, raise the HDL has been shown, HDL cholesterol has been shown to be relatively, completely ineffective. Despite
right.
the fact that low HDL is a risk factor. Well, we don't have the same confidence in ApoA1 as a measurement in a ratio. Is reducing that ratio by raising ApoA, is that going to be beneficial? One would like to think so, but we don't have the evidence for that. So I would put those ratios in the category of good markers for risk, but not necessarily using them, the ratios themselves, as targets.
Yeah. And that's another great point to bring up, to differentiate targets on treatment versus targets with lifestyle changes.
Yeah.
Because there does seem to be a significant difference. You can target the HDL with CETP inhibitors, which have either increased risk or been totally neutral. So clearly the drug manipulation of HDL is not beneficial. But the nutritional manipulation and the lifestyle manipulation theoretically should have a different impact.
Well, you are doing the right things to risk by the proper lifestyle intervention, and that can be reflected by these ratios and by these measurements improving. Absolutely. Whether they are markers or whether they're actually involved in delivering the benefits of those interventions, we don't know, but they go along with the territory. For example, we showed years ago, one of the earliest studies that was able to show changes in HDL was looking at the effects of physical exercise. My
right.
colleague Peter Wood at Stanford was the pioneer of that work, and we were collaborating with him. In fact, when we learned that exercise could raise HDL levels, it convinced me to go out and start running. I was actually very sedentary up until that time. And I decided, well, boy, this is going to raise my HDL. And of course, in retrospect, it's probably the running and not necessarily the raising of the HDL that was beneficial.
Hmm.
But no, you're right. That axis of working on a metabolically healthy nutritional or lifestyle intervention, when it causes changes in these markers, I think it's more or less a reflection of in part of the effects of the benefits of those changes.
Yeah, because one of those changes is increasing fat in the diet, and specifically
yeah.
saturated fat can dramatically improve the ApoB to ApoA1 ratio.
Yeah. Well, there you have to be careful that, you know, that yes, one can do that, or one can keep the ratio high if it's high to begin with. And that has also been shown to people that you can raise the ApoB and the ApoA1 together. Our studies and our look at literature would suggest that that's probably benign.
Yeah.
But we don't know for sure that that's true for everyone.
Right. All right. So we touched on HDL here a little bit. So I want to talk a little bit more about HDL. So when people have an elevated HDL level, whether
yeah.
it's, you know, 70 to 120, and it's, you know, naturally elevated, not on any drugs, would you count that as a beneficial effect, or would you say we need to know more about it? Do you want to know if it's the specific HDL2, or do you want to know if it's what their ApoA1 is, or some greater assessment of HDL function rather than the absolute number?
Yeah, well, as you're indicating, there can be a measurement. There is actually a measurement of HDL function that does appear to reflect its benefit on cardiovascular risk, atherosclerosis development, and that is the ability of HDL to promote the efflux, the removal of cholesterol from tissues, particularly the cells and macrophages in the plaque that lead to plaque development and progression. And there are tests that have been developed that allow that to be measured. Those are not clinically out there. They're really more for research purposes. And what we've been trying to do, what many people have tried to do, including myself, is to try to identify a particular measurement that we can do in the blood of a more standardized nature that doesn't involve having to go into the lab and use cells and culture. And it hasn't been a clear match. So making a shorter answer, we really don't have a particular particle that we can identify. Having said that, I will take credit for one other thing that was sort of lost in literature. I was never convinced that HDL had a beneficial role at all. I felt that what we were seeing, and in fact this is still largely true, people have low HDL also have small LDL, high triglyceride, insulin resistance, and I felt the low HDL was a marker and not causal. Well, this was in the era where we were just starting to make transgenic mouse models, and so my colleague Eddie Rubin and I took a mouse model of atherosclerosis and expressed the human APOA1 gene, so we were able to jack up the A1 levels and make human-like HDL, and guess what? They had less atherosclerosis. So that actually convinced me that there is potentially an important role for this pathway. If you are increasing APOA1 availability, that's probably the best way to reduce risk from the standpoint of HDL raising, and maybe measuring APOA1 is a good reflection of that. But it's really the dynamics, it's the production. So that's been a holy grail in the pharma, which has not yet yielded a drug that has that effect. So it's still, I think, kind of undeveloped as a potential path to be able to pinpoint what it is that reflects that quality. It's doable, we just haven't gotten to the answer yet.
Yeah. So it seems like it's clear that a low level is an increased risk factor based on Framingham data, based on all the observational data we have, that actually a low level of HDL is a better predictor than a high level of LDL. But maybe the higher level of HDL, there's some sort of subset and differentiation right. Still need to make.
But the low level of HDL is a risk factor. I'll come back to the point that when you start introducing the measurements of small LDL, for example, remnant lipoproteins, which is another class of triglyceride particles that are atherogenic, high levels of those particles tend to travel with low levels of HDL. So again, we don't know how much of the risk that is attributed to the low HDL is due specifically to low HDL.
Right.
Some of it probably is, but a lot of it may be related to the co-conspirators that are part of this syndrome,
right.
Metabolic syndrome.
Right, which brings us back to these low-carb hyper-responders with naturally high HDLs in the 80s and 90s, naturally low triglycerides in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and then the LDL cholesterol above 200 or the LDLPs in the 2000 range, and it's uncharted territory with, you know, things coming from both sides.
Yeah, if we have a conversation maybe 2 years from now, maybe we will have completed a study that I've been really anxious to do, and in fact I'm talking about developing, where we at least look at the cause of that hyper response. Is it production? Is it clearance? Is there effect on residence time? Are these particles just sailing through and not causing problems? Maybe they're going the other way. Maybe they're not going to the artery. Maybe they're coming back.
Right.
I mean, these are all kinds of questions that have been out there,
right.
Which have been pure, I mean, more or less pure fantasy because we don't have the data. I think it's one of the more interesting questions that I'd like to address. But having said that, I think, as we talked about a moment ago, there is a subset of individuals who have this trait who, for all intents and purposes, look like they're not going to develop coronary disease, at least over the short term. They have no family history. There's nothing else genetic going on. This higher LDL and LDLP response may be benign in the subset of those individuals. We just need to know who they are.
Right. Yeah. And one thing that's so interesting is a number of physicians, when they see these people, want to label them as a familial hypercholesterolemia and throw them on a statin right away. And that shows sort of, again, the failings of just wanting to hang your hat on one biomarker instead of realizing FH is a constellation, you know, of symptoms, diagnosis, family history,
right.
And physical exam
right.
findings.
And it's one interesting feature. I'll just say that if you have one of the FH genes, if you're heterozygous for FH, you may go through life with high LDLs and never have any problems at all. There are families like that.
Right.
And so it's not always a marker for high risk. Homozygous FH, where you have two genes and you have super high LDLs, that I think is a different category. But there are people who, it gets back to your point, that just based on the LDL alone, even in those patients, may not be sufficient as a means of assessing risk.
So how else would you assess their risk? Would you use calcium scores or CIMT? I mean, other tools do you have in your toolbox?
Well, calcium scores I do use in situations like that. I don't use them a lot routinely, but if there's any question that a patient presents, either genetically or on a low-carb diet, with a high LDLP and what looks like a otherwise healthy metabolic profile, I do use a calcium score as a way of helping to stratify risk, because sometimes I see people who do have some calcium and those I go after. If they don't, it doesn't necessarily give them a clean bill, because after all, the calcium score is just measuring the outcome of a plaque that may have already healed. It's not measuring the cholesterol in other parts of the vessels that are parts of plaques that could become inflamed and rupture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a perfect test in that regard. But if there's a negative family history, and I look at, you know, triglyceride and HDL, small particles, Lp(a), if none of those things apply, it gives me much more confidence to agree with a patient who usually is coming in saying, I don't want to take a statin.
Right.
If they come in and say, I'm willing to take a statin, or I'm interested in taking a statin, I usually don't argue against it, honestly, because I can't really be convinced that it's a safe, that they don't need something. But if I feel that I could support the patient's desire to avoid statin use, particularly, for example, in young women whose absolute risk is so low to start with,
right.
I just worry about that, because, you know, one of the things, and I don't want to overemphasize this because it sometimes can be blown out of proportion, but my major NIH grant right now is to address the basis for adverse effects of statins. So we're studying the mechanisms by which statins can promote muscle damage, myopathy, as well as increased blood sugar levels and increased incidence of diabetes. These effects tend to be written off, by many cardiologists to say, listen, the benefit is so great that
right.
these effects are just not worth worrying about. But if you take an individual whose risk is already low and who's not necessarily likely to get a huge benefit of statin, a young woman, and we know that the risk of developing diabetes is actually higher in women than men, we may be tipping that person into a worse metabolic state by prescribing statins. I don't want to overemphasize that, because people are scared of statins. This is still a minority of the population, but we'd like to find ways of identifying people who are susceptible to those effects so we can advise them in advance. That's another goal that I think eventually could lead to better personalized medicine.
Yeah, such an important statement right there about weighing the risks and the benefits. And you made a comment that so many physicians say, well, the benefits are so great, you should just take it. Well, are the benefits that great? Because that's when we get into the relative versus
right.
absolute, and at what baseline risk are we starting
that's
at?
That's right. The patient population matters a lot. I think there's no doubt, I think, that for patients who've had cardiovascular events, that the clinical trials strongly support the benefit of statin use. It's the sort of intermediate group that looks like they may be at high risk or borderline risk who have not yet had any cardiovascular events that create the quandary for deciding is it going to be more or less harmful to prescribe statins.
Right, and that's where this ASCVD risk calculator comes into play, where you type in their age, where they have hypertension,
right.
diabetes,
right.
and what their LDL and HDL are, and it spits
yeah.
out a number, and based
right.
on that number, you're supposed to treat. But it doesn't
yeah.
involve inflammatory markers. It doesn't involve any of the more advanced testing you talked about, whether ApoB or small the density or Lp(a). Doesn't involve any of that.
Right.
Doesn't even involve triglycerides.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it has a wide margin around it.
Yeah.
So again, this is the product of the world of epidemiology and public health, which likes to look at population data and give numbers that apply to populations. But that population-based risk assessment has a wide variation around it. And if you're dealing with smaller and smaller numbers of individuals and you get down to an N of one, you don't know where you are on
right.
that. So
right.
I am not a huge fan. I mean, I endorse thinking about absolute risk, but I try to integrate more than just the standard tests.
Yeah. Makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. Well, Dr. Krause, I could speak to you for hours about lipids. This is fantastic, but I know we have to get you downstairs here. So tell us what's on the horizon for you and where can people kind of learn more about you and your work?
Well, I do have a page on my website, which is reachable through Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute, and through UCSF, actually. I have an appointment there, so people can find what my laboratory does and the kinds of papers that I've been involved with. That's probably the best way to find. I get people who hear about me through the social media, and they find me in my lab. So that works pretty well.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you for taking the time today. It's been a pleasure.
Very nice speaking with you.